people don't come to us with single issues. Problems don't happen on their own. They happen in clusters, and they certainly don't happen Monday to Friday, 9 to 5.
Hello and welcome to Credit Shift. My name is Paul Sweeney. I am the Chief Strategy Officer here at Webbio. This series will be about how to embrace the digital future of credit and collections, AI, and all things technology. Join us for the conversations that matter about credit and collections. Hello and good afternoon, and welcome to another Credit Shift interview. Today we are joined by Alison Dunn from the Citizens Advice Bureau, a very long time experience in that industry. We're here to hear about all the changes going on there. I am fortunate to be also joined by Mark Opperman, our head of sales here at Webbio. And today we're just going to have a general conversation around the challenges in the credit industry and maybe what we can learn from a strategic point of view. So, Alison, why don't you just kick off with maybe helping us understand what you do there and what the scope of the work you do there, and just give us a feeling for the job that has to be done.
Certainly. So my name is Alison Dunn. I'm the Chief Executive of Citizens Advice Gateshead. I'm also Executive Director of Society Matters, which is a trading company of our main charity. Citizens Advice is a federated structure. So as Citizens Advice Gateshead, we pay a fee in order to be part of the Citizens Advice Network. And that's important for your listeners, because often people think that we are one homogenous group, that we're almost branch offices, but actually we are 270 independent local charities. And although we have a core offer that is similar, because we're independent organisations, we can look and feel quite different from one Citizens Advice to another. Some of us are very large. My own employs about 220 staff, supports about 70 volunteers. But there are others across England and Wales that are much smaller, perhaps with a staffing of around 20. So you can see that there are huge differences in scale. And, you know, that is a strength of our network, because we are all different and hopefully reflect the priorities in our local areas. But it is a challenge, I think, for people when they think about our network, because they assume that they're going to get the same everywhere, and that's not necessarily the case.
You makes a ton of sense. You learn something new every day, I think.
You do, Paul. I was going, really? I didn't know that myself. Yeah. And again, I've come across Citizens Advice so many times.
Yeah, that's...
That's fascinating. Yeah, I didn't know that. So there you go. Every day's a school day, as they say.
Yeah. The other myth that I hear all of the time is that we are funded from the centre, from national government. And actually, that's not the case. We do sometimes have funding that has come from that source, but we've competitively tendered for that funding in the same way that a private sector business would. We don't automatically get distributed funds from national government. And that's another reason why we differ so much in size, because, you know, success from Citizens Advice to Citizens Advice is different based on the resources, capacity, capability, local landscape, and the tendering opportunities that are available. So that also has an impact. So we are charities just like the NSPCC, just like the RSPCA. You know, you'll see them out and about rattling tins. We tend not to rattle tins and get that sort of fundraising, but the way that we operate is just the same as those big sort of high street charities that you're used to seeing.
Could you give us a sense of like the scope of the work you're involved in? Like, some people may not be like aware of all the different things that you do.
Yeah. So no matter which Citizens Advice that you go into, you should be able to get a core offer of money advice, welfare benefits, and housing. That is a core offer for every Citizens Advice in England and Wales. But over and above that, we have our own things that we are passionate about. So in Gateshead, for example, we deliver the consumer service on behalf of National Citizens Advice and the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. We deliver the witness service for the Ministry of Justice. We deliver Advice Line for National Citizens Advice. We deliver a discrimination helpline on behalf of the Legal Aid Agency. We also do some immigration advice. We do a lot of energy advice, financial inclusion. And we have specialist housing contracts here as well. So you get a really broad range of services from Citizens Advice Gateshead. As for the others, you know, it would be for your listeners to reach out to the individual Citizens Advisors to find out exactly what's available at each of their local. But they should, as a minimum, get money, advice, housing and welfare benefits.
That's quite a broad spectrum of understandings and knowledge bases, and just having familiarity with all those different processes. That must be a challenge to keep on top of all that stuff.
Yeah, it's a beast. I mean, to bring it to life for you, we delivered 300,000 digital contacts last year from Citizens Advice Gateshead alone. We supported 20,000 local Gateshead people, and between them, those local people had 110,000 issues. So, you know, people don't come to us with single issues. Problems don't happen on their own. They happen in clusters, and they certainly don't happen Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. So that's one of the reasons why in Gateshead, we're now running a 7-day service. So we're open Saturdays and Sundays here in Gateshead. And, you know, that's proving to be very popular with our residents.
Mark, we found that out of hours question to be a big issue, like people just aren't available when you kind of 9 to 5.
It's interesting, Alison, that you say that. When I look at, say, I pick an example of a client, and just, you know, a simple Excel spreadsheet. One column down, you have the time of day, midnight to 1, 1 to 2, and then you have the day of the week going across the top. And you look at the number of messages that come in to the business, and it's not a huge business, but there is virtually no time or day of the week that there isn't people looking to engage. And it's a collections business. You know, looking to get their account in order or whatever the case may be. But it is stark, really, when you see that on one side of the page, there's two sides to the page of the Excel spreadsheet. On one side, it shows you all the messages that are handled by the Webio agent, the digital assistant, let's call it. And on the other side is where the agents within the business. And it's funny and it's stark, all rolled into one. All the zeros at the top of the page and all the zeros at the bottom of the page are before 8 a.m. and after 6 p.m. that the agents aren't managing any. But you see them when you look at the other side, where the consumers are coming forward, they're wanting to engage 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So really, your point, we see that, okay, every company is the same, but with these issues, you're right. People don't, you know, they're not working 9 to 5. They will, you know, be maybe working different hours, and they will want to engage with people to help resolve some of these issues at a time of their choosing. And it is interesting. Can technology help that? It can in some ways, but sometimes it gets back to you just need people there to have a phone call and be a sympathetic ear, I'm sure, in your case.
I mean, there is a thing called implementation decay, and it tells us that actually only about 40% of people who have a problem will take the action required to solve that problem. And it's not necessarily because they're burying their head in the sand. It's because of, you know, no matter what we might think about debt, it may not be their priority in the moment. And actually, the Money Advice Service has just published a report which sets out the motivations and barriers to seeking debt advice. And they're plentiful. So I think it's incumbent upon us to be available so that when that moment comes and somebody is willing to face the fact that they've have problem debt, we're there to take the call. Because the truth is, if they don't find success in making that call, they may not call back again, and you've lost them.
Interesting. And they're not ringing typically. Do you have to do some investigative work? And I don't want to use that too grandiose term, but you mentioned that they're never coming to you with a single issue. Do you then sometimes have to ask the questions, and layer by layer you're uncovering other issues every time? Is that the normal, or do they come with, I've got these four issues, can you help me?
They rarely come and say, we've got these four issues. There is always something that triggers them to come. So let's talk about evictions, for example. Somebody might come to us and say that they've had an eviction notice and that they're worried about the fact that they're going to have to leave their house. Now, that is a terrible triggering event, but there will have been many, many opportunities on the road to the eviction notice for them to have sought support, and for whatever reason they haven't done. But when we get into the conversation about the eviction, we might well find that there's been a redundancy, that there's been a death, that there's been a relationship breakdown, that there's been a problem accessing benefits, that they might have a disabled child at home or be caring for elderly relatives. That there can be all sorts of things in there. So the thing that brings them to see us is very rarely the root cause of their problem. So they'll come to us with their presenting issue, the trigger that's brought them there, and then there'll be an uncovering of layer upon layer of things which ultimately are the root cause. But also sometimes it can be several months before they trust us sufficiently to give us full disclosure of what's going on as well. You know, you're asking people to bare their soul. They're meeting you for the first time. They're not necessarily going to trust you with their innermost secrets the very first time that they meet you. So sometimes we have to work with people over a long period of time, and they'll reveal it to us bit by bit by bit over a period of time.
Yeah, it's interesting. The way it's explained to me on more than one occasion with our customers that are managing people within debt, it feels like for them, their adult scorecard for life, they're a failure in some way if they're in debt, because it's not, you know, who wants to, you know, you don't grow up thinking, I'd love to be in debt someday. It's not exactly the, so, but it is, as you say, it is a very emotive sort of subject. It's interesting. I don't know if you would see it this, Alison. We certainly would see it from our client's point of view. The shift to being more comfortable in a digital channel versus being on a phone call. Sometimes the digital channel will be the enabler that will build them up to a phone call. But sometimes people, just because it's impersonal, I don't actually have to bare my soul to an agent or a customer service person on the phone, it's easier to communicate over, pick a channel, SMS, WhatsApp, whatever the case may be. Do you notice that, what's your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly get a lot of digital contacts. And when I use the phrase digital, that would include things like webmail, email, WhatsApp, a whole range of channels. But we still have a core cohort that want to see somebody face to face. And I think the challenge for us is that, you know, there is this agenda of digital by default and a push for efficiencies all of the time. And for a service like ours, protecting that face to face service for those that genuinely need it the most is a conundrum that we're constantly wrestling with. Because even the most capable people can be vulnerable for a moment in time. If you are experiencing something like a death or redundancy or relationship breakdown, you may once have been perfectly capable, but whilst you're experiencing that life trauma, you can be paralyzed and need support that you wouldn't necessarily at times in your life need. So we also have to be sensitive to that and recognize that people are at different points on the vulnerability scale depending on what's going on in the context of their lives.
Sure. Could I bring you back for one second to the barriers to seeking help and making contact? Like, we're always talking about engaging and creating situations where people have the opportunity to engage. So I find that very interesting. Maybe you could share some of those reasonings.
Yeah, well, as I say, there's a report just been published called The Motivations and Barriers to Seeking Debt Advice. And I have to say that I feel like I could have wrote this report, actually, because many of the things that are in it, you know, we experience in our day to day. So the first thing to say is that people in the United Kingdom are terribly stiff upper lipped about talking about money. And Mark, you just mentioned it there, you know, it can be really difficult and people feel embarrassed about it. So that's one of the barriers that, you know, they think, well, why is this happening to me? I think if there was any good to come out of welfare reform and COVID and the cost of living crisis, is that some of those stigmas around people only being poor if they are in some way lacking or deficient are starting to fall away, and the stigma of poverty is not as pervasive perhaps as it once was. And in fact, the majority of the people now who come to us about issues of poverty are in paid work. So that does to some extent help to lift that embarrassment and for people to be able to step forward. But, you know, reluctance to talk about money, embarrassment about finding themselves in that situation is a big one. And let's be honest, you know, if we're having financial difficulties, we can feel overwhelmed and we'd rather not think about it. Mm. Or we think that it'll be better next week or better next month or better in 6 months or better when this happens. So a lot of people put in place what they perceive to be a short-term fix that they think is going to solve the problem, but it's not necessarily getting underneath it. So they might, for example, ring and speak to their energy company about putting in place a short-term solution to get them through a period of time and think it's resolved. Well, that's a short-term solution to a problem which is long-term. It's going to need more than just a short-term payment arrangement. So feeling overwhelmed and sort of, you know, hoping that tomorrow it'll just all be better is another problem. And we've talked already about vulnerabilities and how this can come to pass. And how you can be vulnerable one day and not necessarily the next. And again, that's all linked into how people feel about themselves and the situation that they're in. But no matter how big the money challenge is, and if we're involved in credit collection or in providing money advice, we can sometimes think that that is people's biggest challenge and why aren't they dealing with it? But when people have multiple challenges, actually sometimes dealing with debt and money, no matter how important it is to us, is not important to them. We have, in Gateshead, a service which supports the families of children who are experiencing life-limiting and end-of-life conditions. And those people often find that they, where once they had two full-time incomes, they've now got one income. They are struggling with additional childcare costs for siblings that are at home. They have additional costs because they're caring for a child who is terminally ill in some cases. The last thing they're interested in is the fact that they've got debt. The only thing that they are interested in is the child that has fallen ill. So no matter how big it is to us, when people have multiple challenges, it's not always their priority. I mean, this report identifies 10 reasons why people might not be motivated to seek support with debt. I'm not going to go through them all, but I think the embarrassment of money, the feeling of being overwhelmed, the fact that, you know, you may be vulnerable in this situation when perhaps you're not normally, and the fact that you have multiple challenges and it's not necessarily a priority are the things that we see most often.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. We say as well, when we're trying to figure out what a conversation is about, like what the intentions in the conversation are, that life is complicated. Like, there's a lot of things going on. It's not just one or two. And so you've got to balance, you know, various types of vulnerabilities, as well as just the fact that there is a vulnerability. But obviously, in the case that you've mentioned there, being able to probe and find that situation is something maybe that the technology can do a little bit of, but I don't think it's going to get to that kind of level of, I think, empathy, understanding, but also just being able to ask the question in a way that I know, I think in the term, isn't it, to create a kind of an opportunity for disclosure, kind of a space where people feel safe to disclose something. That's, I think, a talent of the individual. It's going to be very hard to automate, in my view.
But just on that point, Paul, that what we've seen is sometimes the whole idea of a phone call, it's quite daunting. I'm going to get on the phone and have a conversation. Or Alison used to say, people wanting to turn up. Sometimes they get to the point that it's one of three or four things. What we've seen, and the data backs up this, is that getting into, I'm going to say, pick a channel, SMS. You're having a conversation back and forth. It's a door opener. And actually, where needed, and it never happened before because these people didn't get on a phone call, 3/4 of the people that engaged over a digital channel then went on to actually have a phone call with an agent within the company. And that really is, it's a bit like that, these guys actually are willing to help. And what we've seen is that I think the the language that people use is incredibly important and powerful. Rather than companies going, you owe us money, we need to talk to you, you know, blah, 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 blah. Being empathetic and getting into a conversation. Look, you're probably, like others, struggling. We want to be able to help. Let's have a discussion. So we find that the language that you use is really, it has an impact on the number of people that you actually, our clients will engage with. So technology is great, but it's about how the clever use of technology is really important. So it can be that door opener into where you have a more meaningful and deeper conversation with somebody face to face or on the phone. But even the methodology of that, as in the language that you use, we see used well can be, you know, massively different to when it's not used as you know, as sensibly as others. One other thing, again, I'd love to know, because what we hear on an ongoing basis is, you mentioned it earlier, Alison, that it's not so much a it's more of an income crisis rather than an employment crisis today, that, you know, with utilities, with, you know, all charges going up and other sort of, you know, inflation and wages not increasing to as quickly as the costs around them. You're seeing this on an ongoing basis where maybe people that would never have come to you guys because of, say, the household income was normally, God, we'd never see somebody with X and above. I'm presuming you're seeing people with that X and above that you typically had never seen before avail of your services today?
In huge numbers, actually. We see an awful lot, a lot now of what I would describe as middle income earners. So people who are in management roles, you know, 35,000 plus type roles, which we wouldn't normally see. Before we had COVID, cost of living crisis, Brexit, Ukraine war, roughly, and don't quote me on this, but roughly about 30% of everyone that we saw was in paid employment. It's now about 55% of everyone that we see is in paid employment. So, you know, those numbers are really, really increasing. And it's really hard for those people, because what's happening, so if I look at my own situation, I was very, very fortunate to have a mortgage at 0.91% that's just gone up to 5.74%. That resulted in an increase in my mortgage payment of £800 per month.
Oh, wow.
Now, where do you find that from?
Behind the couch.
Well,
yeah, no, you don't find it there, I'm afraid. That's phenomenal. But I think that's a lived experience that I'm sure so many others would nod their head and go, well, let me tell you about how much. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is scary when you think of it like that, isn't it?
Yeah. And I've got, you know, I know of people whose mortgages have gone up by similar amounts who have taken action to sell their properties, you know, because it's simply not sustainable for them. So we're talking about huge increases in people's outgoings. So we're talking, you know, mortgages, utilities are going up, food's going up. It's harder to borrow money now. And when you do borrow it, it's more expensive. But also people's savings are exhausted. The credit lines that they would normally use are also exhausted. Family borrowing is exhausted. So people are left with far fewer options. And you know, we're seeing time and time again people who are not just making choices around whether to heat their homes or feed their families. In some cases, it's about whether they can actually afford to turn lights on.
Wow. Yeah. Scary stuff.
We try and follow the numbers every week on the podcast. And just kind of just do a quick check in at the beginning, like what's happening with these prices, because I think it's easy for it to be normalized that it's like, I mean, this is just the new normal. And when you take it from where, you know, that mortgage example, like what is it, 2x electricity costs, 3x heating costs, it there's nothing on the other side of that. Like that's just going up and up and up. And I think it did exhaust savings. I'm still waiting for that to actually filter through properly in the rest of the system to understand that savings are pretty much exhausted now. Yeah. They must be. And then to see what happens next. And I think the like you were just saying, that example of someone making a decision, do I keep paying this heavy mortgage for another year and try and bear it, or do I sell and try and kind of get cheaper rent? Of course, the problem is now someone falls out of the housing market, and then you fall from mortgage payments to rental payments, and private rental is just another escalation path that is very difficult to pay and save to get your next mortgage if you're ever in line for it. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me of that that poverty tax that's kind of embedded in every sort of penalty system. And I'm just kind of interested in exploring that for a little while, just to make people aware of maybe everything doesn't have to be set up like this.
Yeah, so we know that if you're on a low-income household, that it costs you at least £490 a year more just to live. And in some cases, it can be as much as £1,200. I've even heard some people quote £2,500. And this is basically an unfair premium, which is a penalty for living in poverty. And it only exacerbates the difficulties of managing on a low income. And to bring that to life for you, there are a number of ways that this poverty premium arises. So you're using more expensive prepayment meters, for example.
Yeah.
You're not paying for but the cheapest billing method. You're not able to take advantage of direct debit or quarterly payments, for example. But also when you are on a prepayment meter, you're paying for your energy in real time. So I pay for my energy quarterly. It's extrapolated over the course of a year and I pay roughly the same payment 12 months of the year. But if you're on a prepayment meter in the winter months, you are literally paying for your energy as you use it. So for the winter months, your costs are excessively high in real time and you have no option. So that's a challenge. You're often unable to move to the best fuel tariffs as well, perhaps because you've got some debt there or you're not digitally connected in a way that allows you to easily move. You're paying to receive paper bills, again, because you maybe don't have access to the internet. Mm-hmm. But there are also geographical premiums. I mean, you may have heard on the news just this week, actually, a conversation around the fact that people who live in areas where there are high populations of Black, Asian and marginalised ethnic groups are paying significantly more for their insurance premiums than other geographical areas that have similar characteristics. Mm. Now, they're trying to understand what's behind all of that, but there are geographical and demographical issues that can cause your expenses to be higher. So insurance is a big one. You're also often paying more to access money. You know, you're using higher cost credit. And that is a real challenge. And people are going without the basics. So they're not necessarily going to have a chest freezer that allows them to bulk buy from the cheapest options. They may not even have a fridge, so they're having to buy their milk every day. They can't pay for their prescriptions, all these sorts of things. Their washing machine breaks down. They don't have the money to fix it, so they're having to go to a laundrette, which is very expensive. Their appliances may be very old, so they're costing more to run. So there's a huge range of issues that cause people to be paying more simply because they're poor.
I'm smiling not because I'm a cruel person, because I recognize a lot of those issues, like the washing machine being old, then it breaks down, then you bring it to the laundromat and then you see the price of doing your washing and you go, oh my God, that was like a third to half the price of buying a new washing machine.
Yeah.
It was quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that the other one that just strikes me there is when you're in the supermarket and you're looking at the milk and you go like the 1 liter of milk is, let's just say, €1, or actually €2. And then the 2 liter of milk is like €1.50. And then the 3 liter is like €1.20 or whatever. And it's like your price per liter of milk is based on the fact you can't fit it in the fridge because you don't have a fridge. And that's every day and every bit. It's just kind of endemic.
Yeah, and the other thing is the cost of transport. So often if you are living on a low income and you're poor, you are shopping locally. And we know that when you shop from your corner shop, although it's very convenient and, you know, we all want to have a local shop, if that is your main source of getting your weekly shop, then you are going to be paying a lot more for that shop.
Yeah.
And if you can get to a supermarket, but not everybody can afford to do that. And the truth is, if you're disabled, the situation is even worse. So there's a thing called the disability price tag, which is, again, is very similar to the poverty premium. But if you're disabled, you're paying on average £975 a month extra to have the same standard of living as a non-disabled household. Now, that is absolutely astonishing, isn't it? £975 a month more.
Yeah. Yeah. If you've ever seen somebody who's visually, like blind and visually impaired in some other way, seriously, just the ability to get around is completely challenged. Getting cabs here and there is probably a lot of the way you're going to do things. I think it's interesting, Mark, that poverty penalty, thinking about people doing budgets, how you might advise them on budgeting. I don't know how, I'm a genuinely open question. I don't know how well people bring that into their business and start thinking about, like, how might an income and expenditure help in that, or how might understanding.
Yeah, from a compliance point of view, Paul, that, you know, anything, any repayments, anything like that, there has to be, it has to be evidenced for businesses that, you know, this is disposable income and it's affordable. So that's where making those income and expenditures easier to complete, and, you know, not the 25-minute phone call or interrogation, as some people may say, on a phone. And again, even if somebody wanted to sort of change the repayment plan for some reason, again, there needs to be evidence on that. And again, that's where technology can help. And we see that on a daily basis, where you allow people, give them a really good mobile experience. They can do it on their phone. As most people that we're talking about today, their only experience of the web and online, at least 85% of them won't have access to anything other than a mobile. So it has to be mobile friendly. And we've seen, and our clients give us feedback, the whole income and expenditure, it reduces the hassle on the end customer. It's much better for the business. And even the details that are provided are typically of a roughly about 10% more accurate, because if you have somebody on the phone, and I can completely empathize with this, if I was on the phone and somebody was asking me a lot of questions about earnings, this and, you know, what's your outgoings and what have you, you probably would tend to approximate more and give them the answer that you feel that they need to hear. Rather than if you're doing it at home, you can actually check what your energy bill is. You can actually check, as there's no time pressure. And that's something that we see this is where, you know, technology can help. It's just information. It's getting that information in an easy way. Not for everybody, but most people engage in it. And then that information is then passed over to, say, a customer service agent to be able to pick the conversation up from there. So they're more focused on how they can help rather than just data collection. So that's something that we see on an ongoing basis. So, yeah, it's just about where to use it and will it help the overall conversation. So it's a win-win on both sides, both from the business point of view and the end customer that's filling them out.
I also find, drawing on my days of being a money advisor, which was many, many years ago now, but often I used to have conversations with people about their income and expenditure, and they would underestimate what their expenses were because they felt that that's what I wanted them to say.
Yeah.
And then what happens is they agree a payment plan that they're never ever going to be able to meet because they haven't been, able to have the confidence to tell the truth about the things that they are spending money on, which is in nobody's interests. You know, the purpose of an income and expenditure form, in my view, should not be to leave people penniless and sending every single spare penny they have in a different direction. It should be to create a standard of living that allows them to be healthy and addresses the issue of debt. So, you know, underestimating what you are paying is not helping either of those goals. I mean, we've got 5 million people in England, Scotland and Wales who are in a deficit budget right now, and a further 2 million who are cutting back to unsafe levels. And that's a real challenge. So a while ago, I was involved in a piece of work with the Poverty Truth Commission, and I met a chap there who was on paper £5 a month short on his financial statement to be able to meet all of his outgoings. And that doesn't sound like very much, but actually that's £5 a month, assuming absolutely nothing goes wrong in the month, that he doesn't need to get a bus, that he doesn't need a prescription, that he doesn't make a decision to buy a cup of coffee one day, that he doesn't need to buy a birthday card, that nothing comes up that would make that £5 more. And of course, we know that that's not realistic. He had worked full time for many years, had a good job, but then became very ill and had to take part time work. I'm not going to go into the specifics because I don't want to identify the guy. But that £5 deficit resulted in 3 council tax liability orders, an eviction notice, broken relationships, an attempted suicide, and all sorts of torment and turmoil for that gentleman whose life was in complete chaos. Now, it would be very easy as a creditor looking at that income and expenditure sheet to think, well, £5 a month short isn't very much, but it caused all sorts of devastation in his life. So I think, you know, how we deal with the huge numbers of people who are in this situation when we are looking to recover debt, I don't have the answer to it, but it's something that creditors need to think very carefully about, because it doesn't take much to push people into despair. I mean, in the northeast of England, for example, you know, we've got some of the highest male suicide rates in the country. Suicide is not a cause of death, it's a means of death. The cause of death is often problem debt, gambling, relationship breakdown, inability to access services. So we have to be very, very careful when we are considering, in the current climate, the context within which people are living, the stresses that they have, the vulnerabilities that are present, and the economic conditions that we all find ourselves sat in.
Alison, to kind of bring this to kind of the final stages of this kind of interview. That was, I think, really useful to just kind of bring those kind of knock-on effects up to the fore again. I was just wondering, for yourself, managing this service, what do you think the big kind of strategic challenges are for your organization, and what do you struggle with? What's the things that you think are going to be the real big, if I had 3 things I had to do, or 3 big levers, or that kind of simplicity of.
Yeah. So I think there's a few things that I would like to say. When I think about Citizens Advice Gateshead in particular, we are very, very fortunate that we have had a lot of investment from our local government. The chief executive of our local council recognises that health and social inequalities, poverty, inequality, disadvantage are driving people to depths of despair, depths and deaths of despair, and has invested in Citizens Advice Gateshead, which has allowed us to push our services into communities, to be open 7 days a week, to have late night opening, to be able to reach communities of interest, and to do all sorts of innovative things. But it's not the same across the whole network. In the press just last week, we heard of a Citizens Advice in the, further down the country closing for want of £27,000. Now, that is not a lot of money. You know, we generated for Gateshead alone $12 million last year in financial gains, additional income. This year, we've already exceeded $19 million. Once you close your citizens' advice, you're losing that economic advantage as well. So you don't, you know, you're not just saving the money on the funding, you're losing the economic advantage of bringing in all of those financial gains. So I think as a society, we need to think about advice, information and guidance and who is ultimately responsible for paying that, for that. Because if it's not going to be national government, then bearing in mind how reliant the credit industry is on organisations like Citizens Advice, like Step Change, like PayPlan and other third sector organisations, then strategically the creditors may want to think about how they step into this space and work more collaboratively with advice agencies to make sure that these services are available. Because the truth is, clients are often more willing to talk with advice agencies, more willing to disclose to advice agencies than they are to talk to a landlord or a creditor or, you know, anyone else that's chasing them. So I think strategically there needs to be a conversation across the sector about who ultimately is going to pick up the funding for these third sector advice agencies if national and local government are no longer able to do that. There's also something about accessibility. So again, in Gateshead, we've been very, very fortunate that our local authority has supported us with 7-day opening, with extended opening hours to make sure that we have digital access, that we're out in communities, we're doing energy roadshows. We've got a huge, huge programme of activity. But that's not the same everywhere. And as we've already talked about earlier in our conversation, we need to be available at that moment when somebody is willing to face into their problem, because you might only get that one chance. So again, collaborating with third parties to make sure that there is, you know, access to advice, information and guidance is really important. But also thinking about when you are engaging as a creditor with people who have got problems with money, the way that you engage is trauma informed, because actually, we've talked about the weight that problem debt can have on individuals and the role that that plays in the suicide numbers and the huge numbers of people that are waiting for mental health support, and the duty that we all have to treat each other with kindness, care and consideration. Because actually, if we've got 5 million people with a deficit budget and 2 million people cutting back to unsafe levels, what are you chasing them for? You're never, ever going to get that money. So thinking about, you know, trauma-informed responses, the context within which we're all living is also really important. I mean, I could go on, but I'll take a breath.
No, great. I think, as I said, it's great to get that insight and that perspective, because we don't always hear it like up front, and the world is fairly messy. And hard to kind of grapple with in a kind of procedural fashion, because everyone is an individual life and individual circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to a network like Citizens Advice, which, you know, obviously I'm biased, I feel like it's a household name, it's an institution. It's one of those things. If we lose resource capability in our network, it's not coming back. And actually, creditors rely on the network. So if they rely on it and they value it, then they really need to think about how they collaborate with their local citizens' advice and how they can support them through what is an extremely challenging period.
There is billions of unclaimed subsidies and monies there for people that they just haven't tapped into. And that's, you'd question the motivation to try to unlock some of these, because organizations like yourself, you've mentioned Step Change, you're very good at identifying where people can get help. So yeah, it's a real challenge, I would say. Are there any, if you were to, from a, like, you know, we're a pro, like, well, you know, from a Webio perspective, we're a tech company that operates within this space. Are there any sort of takeaways that you've seen where tech has helped you significantly, or sometimes are you just seeing it as a means to an end?
So we have invested hugely in tech in our business and Citizens Advice Gateshead. So we implemented a 4-day working week about 2 years ago now, and that's become part of our business as usual. And we could not have implemented a 4-day working week had we not also embraced digital solutions at the same time.
Gotcha.
We are now much more agile because of that agenda. We've also pushed a lot of our advisors out into communities where they're hosted with third-party organizations. So, you know, they are working remotely, not from the central office. And again, the tech that we have allows us to do that. I think where we perhaps are struggling a little, and I'd be interested in your views on this, Mark, is, you know, we're not really sure yet what the role of AI is going to play in our future. We think that there is definitely a role there, particularly in terms of the front end triage, but I can't imagine it's ever going to replace the face-to-face advice and the sort of the personal touches that we will always need to have. But we are struggling a little bit to understand sort of how far we should go with that. And that's something that we'll be concentrating on in the next sort of 12 to 18 months.
It's an interesting one, Alison, because, again, we've put a lot of time and effort into everybody's heard of ChatGPT and everybody gets excited about, oh, generative AI. And then all of a sudden that you kind of hear all the horror stories of, was it DHL or DPD? I can't remember. That's just one of a long litany of where generative AI unchecked has gone, and, you know, there's been embarrassed faces around. What we've done is that we have built a customized collections language model. We've been doing this for the past 3 to 4 years. And if I just even simplify it, that some people run away with themselves too quickly and say, oh, everything's going to be done by the AI. It's not. Really, AI and automation is great in its own. It can do a job. Agents on their own are brilliant. Really, what we all need to be thinking about is how can we get the two of them to work together and how can they complement each other? Let me give you 3 simple examples of what we see. The first one is entities. So in any conversation, any organization is going to have with somebody, is they have to get a certain amount of information from them. Who are you? What's your date of birth? What's, you know, for an example, a business, what's your account number? Or you're going to have different questions and queries. Now, to be able to get that in a digital form, a lot of the time, you have to have it in a very structured manner. Date of birth has to be day, month, and year. And then somebody puts in something different and the machine goes, that's a no. And it's that perpetual loop of debt then. So that's just one example. So getting and trying to replicate, for example, somebody goes, great, I do need to get your date of birth. And somebody excitedly says, oh, my birthday's tomorrow and I was born in 1980. Now, let me tell you, most machines would just go, no, don't know what you're talking about. Where what we've done is we've looked at all the, and we manage millions of messages every month, but identification is a key element of that. So all that we're doing now is that we know what today's date is. We know what tomorrow's date is. So we're just bringing that, you know, the today's date, what's tomorrow, add 1980, that's your date of birth, put it into the format that the machine is going to recognize. And all of a sudden, it's a good customer experience. Now, the next bit is, on that type of thing there, is that digital always can only deal with one piece of information at a time. It's a bit like a mail. We can't multitask. Or when we try to multitask, we fail miserably. Well, that's what my wife tells me anyway. Don't be smiling, Alison, please.
I'm not going to fall into that trap. Anyone who knows me will be wondering why.
Okay. Well, just rather than just getting one piece of information, now you can be a bit more like, let's say, an agent on the phone. The agent says, I need to get your date of birth, I need to get an account number, I need to get a postcode. Now, no matter what way you respond now on digital, AI can now handle that, check it, and you move it on. The next part is intense. From the conversation, understanding what the person wants early on, you don't have to program anything, it's all built in, and then that you move the conversation in the right manner. Again, Do you know what? Retail have been doing this for years around personalization, giving the customer exactly what they want rather than, you know, and then finally around propensities. And the biggest area here is identifying vulnerability. Now, what people say to you digitally, now we can identify that's exhibiting vulnerability traits. And again, the breakdown of the different types of vulnerability can be identified. And then it allows the business to say, actually, how do we manage the conversation from here? So really what AI can do is add massive value on how you manage the conversation, how you identify the conversation, what information that you put in front of the customer, and then ultimately how you design a customer journey to get the best result, both for the customer and for your organization, to make sure that you can go, actually, we can support that at this time of day, time of the week, whatever the case may be. So there's a lot can be done. I wouldn't be on the super hype curve of saying it'll do everything. That's, to be frank, nonsense. It will help massively. We're not ever going to get rid of, let's say, the need for the agent to be there. So that would be my sort of 2 pence worth on that.
Yeah, I'd say it will do a couple of interesting things. And like Mark was saying, the kind of term that's being used right now is co-pilot. It's like it's a co-pilot for your agent. But people don't really think about it as much as it's also a co-pilot for the customer. It's like saying, you know, you could prompt a customer to go, they've asked something, and maybe you prompt them to go, hey, have you thought about that you might also need this? Or that, let's say people put in a calculation that tends to be wrong, like an expense some sort. You might say, hey, you know, this tends to be more accurate if you take a picture of your last shopping bill. And let's say you just put it on the table and you get a picture of it, and the AI reads the receipt and goes, their shopping bill tends to be £113, right? And so I think that it will, like, in the next 18 months, you're going to see a lot of stuff happening in terms of AI being able to take a picture, take a video, understand voice fluctuations very well. I think there's another layer that has to go in to make that kind of usable in a way that's reliable and auditable, particularly in your environment. So I think a lot is going to happen. There's no doubt that a lot is going to transform. Like just today, Mark, I don't know if you got a chance to see the Klarna, the buy now, pay later lender, said that they had automated over 50% of their questions from customers in a month of launching their conversational AI solution powered by OpenAI. And I think that's going to set off a lot of people thinking about, oh, hold a second, there's a lot of gains to be made there. And there is. It's just that it's careful as you go, understanding, like, we're kind of very much about where the data goes. Like, it's fine for, like, a retailer selling sneakers, but if you're people's financial information, their vulnerability information, stuff that might be medical, it gets a lot more complicated about how you manage that data journey. But none of this is, like, the one thing you can be absolutely certain of is it's absolutely going to play a role over the next 24 months and over the next 5 years. And it'll be everywhere. It'll be in every part of the business, from just stuff that you used to do, you won't be doing anymore.
Roll it out 4 to 5 years and it will be an overnight success. Yeah. Again, it's – but no, listen, the hype curve always – people overestimate it in initial stages, and they underestimate the long-term benefits that it's going to deliver. And you pick 100%. Any new technology that – and that is typically the way. So, yeah. But I think it's about how – and we're going to move away from – just that general chat GPT and everybody gets excited about it, into turning that capability into very specific, like we have done. Ours is collections, language model, customized. Then there will be one for aviation. Then there will be one for farming. Then there'll be one for, you know, biosciences. And then there'll be one, and the list will go on and on. So it will be, it's just a matter of time. But The thing is, you do need data. You need to train it. You need to have the right models. And that's something that we're seeing. It's generating some very significant results, helping customers do a better job on what they did previously.
Anyway, look, I think that's been a fascinating conversation. I think we're up against the time now. I'd just really like to thank you again, Alison, for taking time out of your day to have this conversation with us. I think it's really valuable for everyone to hear this side of the business, bring the reality to the fore again. And I'm sure this is just the start of a continuing conversation. Mark, thank you for bringing your insights today as well. Always very welcome. For our listeners, check in again to the Credit Shift. We have a weekly update for news. We have a series of ongoing monthly interviews with leading figures in the worlds of credit and collections. It is a good way to stay on top of what's happening in the industry and keep things on your strategic radar. So thank you again, everyone, for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for joining us for that amazing conversation. And remember to subscribe so you don't miss any of these future leaders talking about the changes in the credit and collections business. And also, why not drop into webio.com and see what we're doing these days.